4. And that case is Rayburn versus Cigna, and it's appeals 11-1295 and 11-1427. Hi, Mr. Peterson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Pete Peterson. I represent the defendant appellant, Cigna Life Insurance Company of New York. This morning, I would like to discuss first why Cigna's termination of Edward Rayburn's disability benefits constituted a permissible exercise of its discretionary authority under ERISA, even in light of the structural conflict of interest discussed in Glenn v. MetLife. Then I would like to discuss why the district court abused its discretion when it awarded Mr. Rayburn counsel fees under ERISA Section 502G.
Well, I'm going to start you off because you don't have all that much time because I want to talk about your explanations for how Cigna alleviated the conflict of interest. First, you claim that Cigna paid benefits at a time when the SSA had twice denied benefits, but you failed to mention that during that time, those first 2 years, Cigna was obliged to pay if he couldn't perform his current job, and SSA couldn't find disability unless he could not perform any job. And the SSA agreed, by the way, that he could not perform his current job, so there's no real conflict there. Then you claim that you went out and you got this independent medical exam, but at that point, all of the evidence was in his favor. It was not as if you needed someone to break a tie. And it looks far more, I fear, like a hired gun who created the only conflict in the record. And what I need for you to do is to explain to me how any of this demonstrates an avoidance of the conflict of interest.
I'd be happy to try to do that, Your Honor. There was a conflict between the Social Security Administration's two initial denials of Mr. Rayburn's claim and Cigna's approval of that claim. The medical examiners at the Social Security Administration found in mid-2004 and mid-2005 that Mr. Rayburn was not going to be disabled from his occupation as a quality control engineer for longer than 12 months. At the same time, Cigna had been...
Did they say that? I mean, going through the five-step process? I mean, because here's what worries me. Later on, and I'm jumping ahead to the letter of April 7, 2010, you place enormous weight in your brief on this treating physician rule and the ALJ's alleged reliance on it, but it's just a citation to a regulation. So I want to know what the Social Security examiners said about his ability to perform his own job and whether it was really just on a one-year-to-one-year basis.
The medical examiners prepared very short, essentially one-line or one-paragraph reports which stated that we find you are currently unable to perform your occupation, but we do not think that your condition will persist and prevent you from working for a full 12 months. This was a finding made in 2004 when Cigna was paying for benefits and in 2005 when Cigna was paying for benefits.
But as Judge Rovner says, Cigna's obligation was different. You know, I don't know whether you do monthly examinations, but as long as he couldn't perform his own job during that first 24 months, he was entitled to benefits under Cigna, and as long as he couldn't perform his own job, the Social Security Administration would have at least needed to move on to step five.
The second prong of the definition that applied in the first 24 months was or unable to earn 80% of his index covered earnings. So I agree with Your Honor that the definitions were not identical initially.
And I don't see any conflict, therefore.
The factual finding of the examiners, though, was different from the finding of Cigna that he was initially unable to perform his occupation.
But you're painting this as Cigna the Noble has decided to give him money for the first 24 months, even though the Social Security Administration was behaving in an ogre-like way and not saying that he was entitled. And I just don't see that. I think Cigna had language, good for Cigna. I mean, it was following the language of its contract, but I don't see anything inconsistent in what the Social Security people were doing.
Your Honor, I think the primary importance of the disconnect between the initial Social Security position and Cigna's position is that it shows Cigna conducted an independent investigation into Mr. Rayburn's functional capacities, and it wasn't
based.
But
it's not even conflict. Well, anyway, we're
you know,
circles, yeah.
It's Dr. Player, isn't it?
It's Dr. Player.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, I have to tell you, his report seems very odd to me and internally inconsistent. He says that Mr. Rayburn has to use a cane to keep weight off the bad foot, but he also says that Rayburn can carry 20 pounds. He says that Rayburn can climb stairs up to 2.5 hours each day with his cane. So I was trying to figure out when the last time I saw someone with a cane climbing stairs for 2.5 hours a day was, and couldn't figure it out. I mean, it's a report, forgive me, but it's almost silly on its face. And yet Cigna gives it conclusive weight over every treating physician, including the chief of podiatry at a major hospital. I mean, can you explain this report in a way that will make it look rational to me?
The report was based on Dr. Player's actual independent medical exam of Mr. Rayburn. During that time, Mr. Rayburn sat for extended periods of time without displaying signs of discomfort. He maintained a standing posture without displaying pain behavior.
Did he climb stairs for 2.5 hours with his cane?
I think Dr. Player made that assessment based on Rayburn's ability to move with a cane with stability. He moved in and out of the office without difficulty, and he was able to get on and off the examining table without difficulty.
Why does that tell us what he can do for a whole day or a whole week? I mean, is this a case where Cigna ever had Mr. Rayburn watched, or, you know, do we know anything else other than this brief exam that Player did?
Your Honor, there was not surveillance in this case, but it's important to bear in mind that the case law says, even in the presence of the conflict of interest, the fiduciary has discretion to base its benefit decision on the report of a consulting or independent physician.
Here's my issue. I actually don't even see that much difference between the medical findings of Dr. Player and the medical findings of Dr. Sage, for example. And it's really just the ultimate conclusion. You know, what inferences do you draw from those findings? And every doctor, and Dr. Sage was a very distinguished doctor in his field. Other doctors, I'm trying to remember his name, Arnstein maybe.
Adelstein,
yeah. Made the one observation about pain magnification, but never again said anything about that?
It was within Cigna's discretion to base its decision on Dr. Player, who conducted an IME and found that Mr. Rayburn was, in fact, overstating his pain levels.
But without explaining why everybody else is wrong?
Dr. Player did explain his finding. He noted that Rayburn completed a pain drawing that indicated he was engaging in symptom magnification. Dr. Player noted an abnormally high degree of perceived disability, a significant emotional overlay in his perception of pain, and a moderate propensity for symptom magnification and overstatement of pain. Essentially, Dr. Player identified clinical observations about Rayburn that supported his conclusion that Rayburn could work, notwithstanding his complaints of pain caused by degenerative joint disease. And in fact, at the exam...
Why do you have all those operations? I mean, if we look at what the Social Security Administrative Law Judge was focusing on, what you've described are a bunch of subjective assessments of what Mr. Rayburn is reporting, not hard evidence. Whereas we know that he has all these plates put in his foot, he's got the tumor removed at some point, he's got, you know, 5 operations... No one is accusing these doctors of frivolously operating, I'm sure.
But the performance of the surgeries does not equate to the existence of a restriction preventing Mr. Rayburn from working.
But it does suggest that there is persistent, still in need of treatment pain. You don't do an operation for no reason.
Dr. Player reported that Rayborn had not taken Norco since 2 days earlier. And
how many
not
examinations
taken,
did Dr. Player conduct?
Your Honor, he conducted only the one examination.
One, right.
But we would submit that is sufficient to provide a reasonable basis for the decision. But in addition, Dr. Sage reported that Mr. Rayborn only took 1 to 3 Norcos per week as needed. Dr. Adelstein reported that Rayborn did not suffer any impairment as a result of the pain medications that he used.
Listen, on the one occasion that Dr. Adelstein found Rayborn's pain playing out of proportion to his symptoms, Dr. Adelstein had just performed unsuccessful surgery on Rayborn, a surgery that had to be reversed. And after that initial impression, neither he nor Dr. Sage ever found that Rayborn's complaint of pain was unfounded. And I don't know that your hired expert ever found a subjective complaint of pain founded. I mean,
The fact that Dr. Player was paid in order to provide the independent medical examination does not call his objectivity into doubt any more than the treating relationship between Dr. Sage and Rayborn does.
Look, I never mentioned the fact that he was paid. I've seen a few of these cases in my life. People do get paid. The bottom line here is that Cigna has pretty much disregarded all the evidence that was favorable to the plaintiff. No one understands better than I that you can credit an independent medical expert. But I don't see where the rationale is for throwing out all the other opinions.
Well, as Your Honor stated, the fiduciary has discretion when faced with competing medical reports to base the determination on the independent physician's report rather than the treating physician's report when it is well-reasoned. And we believe the record shows that Cigna did consider all of the evidence that supported Mr. Rayborn's claim. This is reflected first by its payment of the claim for over 24 months, and later in the claim notes and the appeal correspondence in which Cigna carefully cataloged all of the evidence that Mr. Rayborn submitted in support of his appeals. The claim letters acknowledge the evidence along with the contrary evidence, which included not only the report of Dr. Player, but a transferable skills assessment and two reports by reviewing physicians who reviewed the records and concluded that Mr. Rayborn's appeal evidence was insufficient to show that the Dr. Player's original report was incorrect. Cigna, as a fiduciary with discretion, had permissible discretion to base its decision on Dr. Player's report because it was well reasoned and he thoroughly explained his findings. I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'd also like to just quickly address two of the errors that the district judge made in his judgment order. The judge stated that it was logically impossible for Mr. Rayborn to be disabled under the Act, but not under the policy. Well, in fact, the administrative law judge did not have the same evidence that Cigna had when he decided the claim, so the evidence was different. And in addition, the administrative law judge's decision was governed by the treating physician rules, which required him to defer to the treating source's opinion about the severity and nature of Mr. Rayborn's apparent.
Which he never actually, he cites it, but he does not say, I'm doing that, though. I've seen plenty of ALJ opinions from the Social Security Administration where they do discuss the treating physician rule and give it some weight, but this doesn't happen to be one of them.
I believe, Your Honor, I don't have the opinion in front of me. He said, I evaluated the evidence in accordance with 404, 1529, and 1527. which required him to defer to the physician's.
Right. It's a site. He doesn't, in fact, explain. But anyway.
One other significant error in Judge Gettleman's opinion was that Dr. Player had ignored certain surgeries that Mr. Rayborn received. In fact, Rayborn now concedes in his appellate briefs that Dr. Player cataloged all of the surgeries. Judge Gettleman's error on this point was prejudicial because it suggested a false parallel between this case and Glenn v. MetLife. I've used up my time. Thank you.
I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hi, Mr. Dubofsky. Sitting where I've never seen you sit before. This is.
May it please the court.
19 years of that. How are you?
I have to agree. It is a strange experience for me to be sitting on that side of the courtroom. Other than to just mention one point as to the merits that hasn't been addressed yet, and that's the fact that Cigna advocated on Mr. Rayburn's behalf to the Social Security Administration and then completely disregarded the results of the adjudication after they had collected $27,000 back from Mr. Rayburn. And that is a significant factor that this court took issue with in the Ladd case and that the Supreme Court took issue with in the MetLife versus Glenn case. Nothing in Cigna's post-remand letter written by Mr. Sharp even made mention of that fact that Cigna had advocated to Social Security on Mr. Rayburn's behalf through a representative. Other than that, with respect to the merits, unless the court has any specific questions, I would just like to say a few words about the attorney's fee award.
And I wanted you to talk about that, too, because I'm quite concerned that the district court, I guess I'll use the word overreacted on the substantial justification point. I can certainly understand after Hart the some success factor needs to be correlated somehow with the substantial justification test. But I don't see anything in Hart that throws substantial justification out the window. And I'm very concerned that the district court didn't apply the right standard to this fee award.
Your Honor, I've actually been giving the matter significant thought over the last few days as I was preparing for this argument and reached some realizations that weren't necessarily discussed at length in our briefs. The substantial evidence test that this court has used in ERISA fee awards is adapted from the Equal Access to Justice Act.
The substantial justification.
Correct.
You mean to say. Yeah, right.
Equal Access to Justice Act specifically requires that that be taken into consideration.
Right.
And EJA also has a prevailing party requirement. The emphasis that the Supreme Court made in Hart was that there was no prevailing party requirement, and 29 U.S.C. Section 1132G has to be read literally. Courts are not to read into the statute language that isn't in the statute. So the opinion that Magistrate Judge Denlow had written, that Judge Gettleman relied on, which suggested that the substantial justification test may no longer be viable, makes a lot of sense in the context. The Hart decision explicitly stated that the only circumscription, I'm having the same problem as Your Honor today, of the district judge's discretion is that there has to be some degree of success on the merits, and it can't be a trivial success or a purely procedural victory.
No, I understand that, and that the court took a very strict approach to the statutory language here, this one. But then there's this Delphic footnote in Hart that, after rejecting these five-factor tests, says, well, we're actually not killing them off. You know, they may still have some role. And factor five is the relative merits of the party's positions in that test. And so I'm quite honestly struggling, you know, with what did they mean? I understand that this statute isn't the Equal Access to Justice Act, and if the court hadn't dropped that footnote, I might have said that Judge Denlow was right, that these old things are really not there, but how are we to make sense of this all?
Well, what I was going to say is that I think if anything survives, the five-factor test survives more readily than the substantial justification test. And Judge Gettleman did go through the five factors in the opinion, and he also did ultimately conclude, and this is a quote, "Consequently, whether or not the substantial justification or five-factor test remain viable, plaintiff is entitled to fees."
Yeah, he applied it in the alternative, it seems to me.
So that Judge Gettleman did give this reviewing court an opportunity to review his decision and whether he acted within the scope of his discretion. And certainly when we talk about the relative merits of the parties' positions, in the discussion today and in the briefing, there's been substantial discussion about all of this evidence favored Mr. Rayburn. The Social Security Administration favored Mr. Rayburn. Cigna advocated on Mr. Rayburn's behalf before the Social Security Administration. So the relative merits very clearly favor Mr. Rayburn. And then if we look at factors 3 and 4.
And he won everything he asked for.
Complete victory. There wasn't anything that he didn't get. And the factors 3 and 4 about deterrence and benefits to others, we dropped a footnote in our brief indicating a litany of cases where Cigna has been explicitly criticized not for acting arbitrarily, but for specifically because they ignored the Social Security decision, as they did in this case. So this does create a deterrent effect. This does benefit other claimants who might have been awarded Social Security disability and then are applying for benefits. And then finally, the issue that the matter be divided into phases is completely inconsistent with all of the case law. If you go back to Hensley versus Eckerhart, the court says you look at the whole. In all of the EJIA cases, to the extent that EJIA has any real viability, you look at the whole. You look at the ultimate result that matters. And the fact that the plaintiff didn't win on every single issue, there was one goal in this litigation, which was to restore Mr. Rayburn's benefits. That goal was completely met. There is no mitigation of that. And Judge Gettleman's award of fees was entirely within the scope of his discretion. So unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you. You very much, Mr. Butsky. Mr. Pedersen.
Thank you, Your Honor. The question under the fee award is not whether Mr. Rayburn won what he was seeking. He did. The question is whether the defendant's position was substantially justified. It
Where
clearly
does that
was.
Come from in this statute, given the approach Hart tells us to take?
Hart says that fee awards under ERISA are governed by the same principles that govern fee awards under the Clean Air Act, and the Clean Air Act case is Ruckelshaus v. Sierra Club, which adopted the some degree of success standard and stated that fee awards should still be informed by the American rule, which states that generally each side bears its own costs. This court has stated since Hart that the substantial justification test remains binding. And under that test,
but that way, if you got some degree of success, let's say 50%, and you failed on 50%, not this case, by the way, then I would imagine the non-prevailing party as to that part would be substantially justified. I don't think that makes any sense out of Hart.
Well, Hart says that the five-factor test can still be applied, and this court has held that the substantial justification test specifically continues to apply. In Colby,
Hart actually takes no position on it. They said we're not going to rule on that. That's that footnote that I was talking about.
Well, that's correct. It certainly doesn't foreclose the test, and this court has held that the test continues to apply. Cigna's position clearly was supported by the law. It was right about the standard of review. A fiduciary may base its benefit decision on
Why does any of that matter, though, if you lost in the end? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that
Because a position to be substantially justified need not be meritorious. It only need be more than frivolous and not taken simply for the purpose of harassing the opponent. And in this case, Cigna fairly and fully discharge its obligations under the statute by fully reviewing Mr. Rayborn's appeals and not terminating benefits until it actually had an independent medical examination by a board-certified surgeon who found that the claimant's pain levels were not disabling. So we would submit that the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
Okay. So thanks to both parties, and the case will be taken under advisement.